only by the difference of their characters. The rhetorician Eugenius, who had almost acquired the dominion of the world, was reduced to implore the mercy of the conqueror, and the unrelenting soldier separated his head from his body as he lay prostrate at the feet of Theodosius. Of Augustus, after the loss of a battle in which he had discharged the duties of a soldier and a general, wandered several days among the mountains. But when he was convinced that his cause was desperate and his escape impracticable, the intrepid barbarian imitated the example of the ancient Romans and turned his sword against his own breast. The fate of the empire was determined in a narrow corner of Italy, and the legitimate successor of the House of Valentinian embraced the Archbishop of Milan, and graciously received the submission of the provinces of the West. Those provinces were involved in the guilt of rebellion, while the inflexible courage of Ambrose alone had resisted the claims of successful usurpation. With a manly freedom which might have been fatal to any other subject, the Archbishop rejected the gifts of Eugenius, declined his correspondence, and withdrew himself from Milan to avoid the odious presence of a tyrant whose downfall he predicted in discreet and ambiguous language. The merit of Ambrose was applauded by the conqueror, who secured the attachment of the people by his alliance with the Church, and the clemency of Theodosius is ascribed to the humane intercession of the Archbishop of Milan. After the defeat of Eugenius, the merit as well as the authority of Theodosius was cheerfully acknowledged by all the inhabitants of the Roman world. The experience of his past conduct encouraged the most pleasing expectations of his future reign, and the age of the emperor, which did not exceed 50 years, seemed to extend the prospect of the public felicity. His death, only 4 months after his victory, was considered by the people as an unforeseen and fatal event which destroyed, in a moment, the hopes of the rising generation, and that the indulgence of ease and luxury had secretly nourished the principles of disease. The strength of Theodosius was unable to support the sudden and violent transition from the palace to the camp, and the increasing symptoms of a dropsy announced the speedy dissolution of the emperor. The opinion and perhaps the interest of the public had confirmed the division of the Eastern and Western empires, and the two royal youths, Arcadius and Honorius, who had already obtained from the tenderness of their father the title of Augustus, were destined to fill the thrones of Constantinople and of Rome. Those princes were not permitted to share the danger and glory of the civil war, but as soon as Theodosius had triumphed over his unworthy rivals, he called his younger son, Honorius, to enjoy the fruits of the victory, and to receive the scepter of the West from the hands of his dying father. The arrival of Honorius at Milan was welcomed by a splendid exhibition of the games of the circus, and the emperor, though he was oppressed by the weight of his disorder, contributed by his presence to the public joy. But the remains of his strength were exhausted by the painful effort which he made to assist at the spectacles of the morning. Honorius supplied during the rest of the day the place of his father, and the great Theodosius expired in the ensuing night. Notwithstanding the recent animosities of a civil war, his death was universally lamented. The barbarians whom he had vanquished and the churchmen by whom he had been subdued celebrated with loud and sincere applause the qualities of the deceased emperor, which appeared the most valuable in their eyes. The Romans were terrified by the impending dangers of a feeble and divided administration, and every disgraceful moment of the unfortunate reigns of Arcadius and Honorius revived the memory of their irreparable loss. In the faithful picture of the virtues of Theodosius, his imperfections have not been dissembled. The act of cruelty and the habits of indolence which tarnished the glory of one of the greatest of the Roman princes. An historian perpetually adverse to the fame of Theodosius has exaggerated his vices and their pernicious effects. He boldly asserts that every rank of subjects imitated the effeminate manners of their sovereign, and that every species of corruption polluted the course of public and private life, and that the feeble restraints of order and decency were insufficient to resist the progress of that degenerate spirit which sacrifices without a blush the consideration of duty and interest to the base indulgence of sloth and appetite. The complaints of contemporary writers who deplore the increase of luxury and deprivation of manners are commonly expressive of their peculiar temper and situation. There are few observers who possess a clear and comprehensive view of the revolutions of society, and who are capable of discovering the nice and secret springs of action which impel in the same uniform direction the blind and capricious passions of a multitude of individuals. If it can be affirmed with any degree of truth that the luxury of the Romans was more shameless and dissolute in the reign of Theodosius than in the age of Constantine, perhaps, or of Augustus, the alteration cannot be ascribed to any beneficial improvements which had gradually increased the stock of national riches. A long period of calamity or decay must have checked the industry and diminished the wealth of the people, and their profuse luxury must have been the result of that indolent despair which enjoys the present hour and declines the thoughts of futurity. The uncertain condition of their property discouraged the subjects of Theodosius from engaging in those useful and laborious undertakings which require an immediate expense and promise a slow and distant advantage. The frequent examples of ruin and desolation tempted them not to spare the remains of a patrimony which might every hour become the prey of the rapacious Goth. And the mad prodigality which prevails in the confusion of a shipwreck or a siege may serve to explain the progress of luxury amid the misfortunes and terrors of a sinking nation. The effeminate luxury which infected the manners of courts and cities had instilled a secret and destructive poison into the camps of the legions, and their degeneracy has been marked by the pen of a military writer who had accurately studied the genuine and ancient principles of Roman discipline. It is the just and important observation of Vegetius that the infantry was invariably covered with defensive armor from the foundation of the city to the reign of the Emperor Gratian. The relaxation of discipline and the disuse of exercise rendered the soldiers less able and less willing to support the fatigues of the service. They complained of the weight of the armor, which they seldom wore, and they successively obtained the permission of laying aside both their cuirasses and their helmets. The heavy weapons of their ancestors, the short sword and the formidable pilum, which had subdued the world, insensibly dropped from their feeble hands. As the use of the shield is incompatible with that of the bow, they reluctantly marched into the field. Condemned to suffer either the pain of wounds or the ignominy of flight, and always disposed to prefer the more shameful alternative. The cavalry of the Goths, the Huns, and the Alani had felt the benefits and adopted the use of defensive armor, and as they excelled in the management of missile weapons, they easily overwhelmed the naked and trembling legions, whose heads and breasts were exposed, without defense, to the arrows of the barbarians. The loss of armies, the destruction of cities, and the dishonor of the Roman name ineffectually solicited the successors of Gratian to restore the helmets and the cuirasses of the infantry. The enervated soldiers abandoned their own and the public defense, and their pusillanimous indolence may be considered as the immediate cause of the downfall of the empire. Chapter 28. Destruction of Paganism. Final Destruction of Paganism. Introduction of the Worship of Saints and Relics Among the Christians. Part 1. The ruin of paganism in the age of Theodosius is perhaps the only example of the total extirpation of any ancient and popular superstition, and may therefore deserve to be considered as a singular event in the history of the human mind. The Christians, more especially the clergy, had impatiently supported the prudent delays of Constantine and the equal toleration of the elder Valentinian. Nor could they deem their conquest perfect or secure, as long as their adversaries were permitted to exist. The influence which Ambrose and his brethren had acquired over the youth of Gratian and the piety of Theodosius was employed to infuse the maxims of persecution into the breasts of their imperial proselytes. Two specious principles of religious jurisprudence were established, from whence they deduced a direct and rigorous conclusion against the subjects of the empire who still adhered to the ceremonies of their ancestors, that the magistrate is in some measure guilty of the crimes which he neglects to prohibit or to punish, and that the idolatrous worship of fabulous deities and real demons is the most abominable crime against the supreme majesty of the Creator. The laws of Moses and the examples of Jewish history were hastily, perhaps erroneously, applied by the clergy to the mild and universal reign of Christianity. The zeal of the emperors was excited to vindicate their own honor and that of the deity, and the temples of the Roman world were subverted about 60 years after the conversion of Constantine. From the age of Numa to the reign of Gratian, the Romans preserved the regular succession of the several colleges of the sacerdotal order. 15 pontiffs exercised their supreme jurisdiction over all things and persons that were consecrated to the service of the gods, and the various questions which perpetually arose in a loose and traditionary system were submitted to the judgment of their holy tribunal. 15 grave and learned augurs observed the face of the heavens and prescribed the actions of heroes according to the flight of birds. 15 keepers of the Sibylline books, their name of quindecimvirs, was derived from their number, occasionally consulted the history of future and, as it should seem, of contingent events. 6 Vestals devoted their virginity to the god of the sacred fire and of the unknown pledges of the duration of Rome, which no mortal had been suffered to behold with impunity. 7 Epulus prepared the table of the gods, conducted the solemn procession, and regulated the ceremonies of the annual festival. The 3 Flamines of Jupiter, of Mars, and of Quirinus were considered as the peculiar ministers of the 3 most powerful deities who watched over the fate of Rome and of the universe. The king of the sacrifices represented the person of Numa and of his successors in the religious functions which could be performed only by royal hands. The confraternities of the Salians, the Lupercals, etc., practiced such rites as might extort a smile of contempt from every reasonable man with a lively confidence of recommending themselves to the favor of the immortal gods. The authority which the Roman priests had formerly obtained in the councils of the Republic was gradually abolished by the establishment of monarchy and the removal of the seat of empire. But the dignity of their sacred character was still protected by the laws and manners of their country, and they still continued, more especially the College of Pontiffs, to exercise in the capital and sometimes in the provinces the rights of their ecclesiastical and civil jurisdiction. Their robes of purple, chariots of state, and sumptuous entertainments attracted the admiration of the people, and they received from the consecrated lands and the public revenue an ample stipend which liberally supported the splendor of the priesthood and all the expenses of the religious worship of the state. As the service of the altar was not incompatible with the command of armies, the Romans, after their consulships and triumphs, aspired to the place of pontiff or of augur. The seats of Cicero and Pompey were filled in the 4th century by the most illustrious members of the Senate, and the dignity of their birth reflected additional splendor on their sacerdotal character. The 15 priests who composed the College of Pontiffs enjoyed a more distinguished rank as the companions of their sovereign, and the Christian emperors condescended to accept the robe and incense which were appropriated to the office of supreme pontiff. But when Gratian ascended the throne, more scrupulous or more enlightened, he sternly rejected those profane symbols, applied to the service of the state or of the church, the revenues of the priests and vestals, abolished their honors and immunities, and dissolved the ancient fabric of Roman superstition which was supported by the opinions and habits of 1100 years. Paganism was still the constitutional religion of the Senate. The hall, or temple, in which they assembled, was adorned by the statue and altar of Victory, a majestic female standing on a globe, with flowing garments, expanded wings, and a crown of laurel in her outstretched hand. The senators were sworn on the altar of the goddess to observe the laws of the emperor and of the empire, and a solemn offering of wine and incense was the ordinary prelude of their public deliberations. The removal of this ancient monument was the only injury which Constantius had offered to the superstition of the Romans. The altar of Victory was again restored by Julian, tolerated by Valentinian, and once more banished from the Senate by the zeal of Gratian. But the emperor yet spared the statues of the gods which were exposed to the public veneration. 424 temples, or chapels, still remain to satisfy the devotion of the people, and in every quarter of Rome the delicacy of the Christians was offended by the fumes of idolatrous sacrifice. But the Christians form the least numerous party in the Senate of Rome, and it was only by their absence that they could express their dissent from the legal, though profane, acts of a pagan majority. In that assembly, the dying embers of freedom were, for a moment, revived and inflamed by the breath of fanaticism. 4 respectable deputations were successively voted to the imperial court to represent the grievances of the priesthood and the Senate, and to solicit the restoration of the altar of Victory. The conduct of this important business was entrusted to the eloquent Symmachus, a wealthy and noble senator who united the sacred characters of pontiff and augur with the civil dignities of proconsul of Africa and prefect of the city. The breast of Symmachus was animated by the warmest zeal for the cause of expiring paganism, and his religious antagonists lamented the abuse of his genius and the inefficacy of his moral virtues. The orator, whose petition is extant to the emperor Valentinian, was conscious of the difficulty and danger of the office which he had assumed. He cautiously avoids every topic which might appear to reflect on the religion of his sovereign. Humbly declares that prayers and entreaties are his only arms, and artfully draws his arguments from the schools of rhetoric rather than from those of philosophy. Symmachus endeavors to seduce the imagination of a young prince by displaying the attributes of the goddess of Victory. He insinuates that the confiscation of the revenues, which were consecrated to the service of the gods, was a measure unworthy of his liberal and disinterested character, and he maintains that the Roman sacrifices would be deprived of their force and energy if they were no longer celebrated at the expense as well as in the name of the Republic. Even skepticism is made to supply an apology for superstition. The great and incomprehensible secret of the universe eludes the inquiry of man. Where reason cannot instruct, custom may be permitted to guide, and every nation seems to consult the dictates of prudence by faithful attachment to those rights and opinions which have received the sanction of ages. If those ages have been crowned with glory and prosperity, if the devout people have frequently obtained the blessings which they have solicited at the altars of the gods, it must appear still more advisable to persist in the same salutary practice, and not to risk the unknown perils that may attend any rash innovations. The test of antiquity and success was applied with singular advantage to the religion of Numa, and Rome herself, the celestial genius that presided over the fates of the city, is introduced by the orator to plead her own cause before the tribunal of the emperors. "Most excellent princes," says the venerable matron, "fathers of your country, pity and respect my age, which has hitherto flowed in an uninterrupted course of piety. Since I do not repent, permit me to continue in the practice of my ancient rites. Since I am born free, allow me to enjoy my domestic institutions. This religion has reduced the world under my laws. These rites have repelled Hannibal from the city, and the Gauls from the capital. Were my grey hairs reserved for such intolerable disgrace? I am ignorant of the new system that I am required to adopt, but I am well assured that the correction of old age is always an ungrateful and ignominious office. The fears of the people supplied what the discretion of the orator had suppressed, and the calamities which afflicted or threatened the declining empire were unanimously imputed by the pagans to the new religion of Christ and of Constantine. But the hopes of Symmachus were repeatedly baffled by the firm and dexterous opposition of the Archbishop of Milan, who fortified the emperors against the fallacious eloquence of the advocate of Rome. In this controversy, Ambrose condescends to speak the language of a philosopher, and to ask with some contempt why it should be thought necessary to introduce an imaginary and invisible power as the cause of those victories which were sufficiently explained by the valour and discipline of the legions. He justly derides the absurd reverence for antiquity, which could only tend to discourage the improvements of art and to replunge the human race into their original barbarism. From thence, gradually rising to a more lofty and theological tone, he pronounces that Christianity alone is the doctrine of truth and salvation, and that every mode of polytheism conducts its deluded votaries through the paths of error to the abyss of eternal perdition. Arguments like these, when they were suggested by a favorite bishop, had power to prevent the restoration of the altar of victory. But the same arguments fell, with much more energy and effect, from the mouth of a conqueror, and the gods of antiquity were dragged in triumph at the chariot wheels of Theodosius. In a full meeting of the Senate, the emperor proposed, according to the forms of the Republic, the important question whether the worship of Jupiter or that of Christ should be the religion of the Romans. The liberty of suffrages, which he affected to allow, was destroyed by the hopes and fears that his presence inspired. And the arbitrary exile of Symmachus was a recent admonition that it might be dangerous to oppose the wishes of the monarch. On a regular division of the Senate, Jupiter was condemned and degraded by the sense of a very large majority, and it is rather surprising that any members should be found bold enough to declare by their speeches and votes that they were still attached to the interest of an abdicated deity. The hasty conversion of the Senate must be attributed either to supernatural or to sordid motives, and many of these reluctant proselytes betrayed on every favorable occasion their secret disposition to throw aside the mask of odious dissimulation. But they were gradually fixed in the new religion as the cause of the ancient became more hopeless. They yielded to the authority of the emperor, to the fashion of the times, and to the entreaties of their wives and children, who were instigated and governed by the clergy of Rome and the monks of the East. The edifying example of the Anician family was soon imitated by the rest of the nobility. The Bassi, the Paulini, the Gracchi embraced the Christian religion, and the luminaries of the world, the venerable assembly of Cato's, such are the high-flown expressions of Prudentius, were impatient to strip themselves of their pontifical garment, to cast the skin of the old serpent, to assume the snowy robes of baptismal innocence, and to humble the pride of the consular fasces before tombs of the martyrs. The citizens, who subsisted by their own industry, and the populace, who were supported by the public liberality, filled the churches of the Lateran and Vatican with an incessant throng of devout proselytes. The decrees of the Senate, which prescribed the worship of idols, were ratified by the general consent of the Romans. The splendor of the capital was defaced, and the solitary temples were abandoned to ruin and contempt. Rome submitted to the yoke of the gospel, and the vanquished provinces had not yet lost their reverence for the name and authority of Rome. Part 2. The filial piety of the emperors themselves engaged them to proceed with some caution and tenderness in the reformation of the Eternal City. Those absolute monarchs acted with less regard to the prejudices of the provincials. The pious labor which had been suspended near 20 years since the death of Constantius was vigorously resumed and finally accomplished by the zeal of Theodosius. Whilst that warlike prince yet struggled with the Goths, not for the glory but for the safety of the Republic, he ventured to offend a considerable party of his subjects by some acts which might perhaps secure the protection of heaven, but which must seem rash and unseasonable in the eye of human prudence. The success of his first experiments against the pagans discouraged the pious emperor to reiterate and enforce his edicts of proscription. The same laws which had been originally published in the provinces of the East were applied, after the defeat of Maximus, to the whole extent of the Western Empire, and every victory of the Orthodox Theodosius contributed to the triumph of the Christian and Catholic faith. He attacked superstition in her most vital part by prohibiting the use of sacrifices, which he declared to be criminal as well as infamous. And if the terms of his edicts more strictly condemned the impious curiosity which examined the entrails of the victim, every subsequent explanation tended to involve in the same guilt the general practice of immolation, which essentially constituted the religion of the pagans. As the temples had been erected for the purpose of sacrifice, it was the duty of a benevolent prince to remove from his subjects the dangerous temptation of offending against the laws which he had enacted. A special commission was granted to Canigius, the praetorian prefect of the East, and afterwards to the counts Jovius and Gaudentius, two officers of distinguished rank in the West, by which they were directed to shut the temples, to seize or destroy the instruments of idolatry, to abolish the privileges of the priests, and to confiscate the consecrated property for the benefit of the emperor, of the church, or of the army. Here the desolation might have stopped, and the naked edifices, which were no longer employed in the service of idolatry, might have been protected from the destructive rage of fanaticism. Many of those temples were the most splendid and beautiful monuments of Grecian architecture, and the emperor himself was interested not to deface the splendor of his own cities, or to diminish the value of his own possessions. Those stately edifices might be suffered to remain as so many lasting trophies of the victory of Christ. In the decline of the arts, they might be usefully converted into magazines, manufactures, or places of public assembly. And perhaps, when the walls of the temple had been sufficiently purified by holy rites, the worship of the true deity might be allowed to expiate the ancient guilt of idolatry. But as long as they subsisted, the pagans fondly cherished the secret hope that an auspicious revolution, a second Julian, might again restore the altars of the gods, and the earnestness with which they addressed their unavailing prayers to the throne increased the zeal of the Christian reformers to extirpate, without mercy, the root of superstition. The laws of the emperors exhibit some symptoms of a milder disposition, but their cold and languid efforts were insufficient to stem the torrent of enthusiasm and rapine which was conducted, or rather impelled, by the spiritual rulers of the church. In Gaul, the holy Martin, bishop of Tours, marched at the head of his faithful monks to destroy the idols, the temples, and the consecrated trees of his extensive diocese. And in the execution of this arduous task, the prudent reader will judge whether Martin was supported by the aid of miraculous powers or of carnal weapons. In Syria, the divine and excellent Marcellus, as he is styled by Theodoret, a bishop animated with apostolic fervor, resolved to level with the ground the stately temples within the diocese of Apamea. His attack was resisted by the skill and solidity with which the Temple of Jupiter had been constructed. The building was seated on an eminence. On each of the four sides, the lofty roof was supported by 15 massy columns, 16 feet in circumference, and the large stone of which they were composed were firmly cemented with lead and iron. The force of the strongest and sharpest tools had been tried, without effect. It was found necessary to undermine the foundations of the columns, which fell down as soon as the temporary wooden props had been consumed with fire, and the difficulties of the enterprise are described under the allegory of a black demon who retarded, though he could not defeat, the operations of the Christian engineers. Elated with victory, Marcellus took the field in person against the powers of darkness. A numerous troop of soldiers and gladiators marched under the episcopal banner, and he successively attacked the villages and country temples of the diocese of Apamea. Whenever any resistance or danger was apprehended, the champion of the faith, whose lameness would not allow him either to fight or fly, placed himself at a convenient distance, beyond the reach of darts. But this prudence was the occasion of his death. He was surprised and slain by a body of exasperated rustics, and the synod of the province pronounced without hesitation that the holy Marcellus had sacrificed his life in the cause of God. In the support of this cause, the monks, who rushed with tumultuous fury from the desert, distinguished themselves by their zeal and diligence. They deserved the enmity of the pagans, and some of them might deserve the reproaches of avarice and intemperance. Of avarice, which they gratified with holy plunder, and of intemperance, which they indulged at the expense of the people who foolishly admired their tattered garments, loud psalmody, and artificial paleness. A small number of temples was protected by the fears, the venality, the taste, or the prudence of the civil and ecclesiastical governors. The temple of the celestial Venus at Carthage, whose sacred precincts formed a circumference of 2 miles, was judiciously converted into a Christian church, and a similar consecration had preserved inviolate the majestic dome of the Pantheon at Rome. But in almost every province of the Roman world, an army of fanatics, without authority and without discipline, invaded the peaceful inhabitants, and the ruin of the fairest structures of antiquity still displays the ravages of those barbarians who alone had time and inclination to execute such laborious destruction. In this wide and various prospect of devastation, the spectator may distinguish the ruins of the Temple of Serapis at Alexandria. Serapis does not appear to have been one of the native gods or monsters who sprung from the fruitful soil of superstitious Egypt. The first of the Ptolemies had been commanded, by a dream, to import the mysterious stranger from the coast of Pontus, where he had been long adored by the inhabitants of Sinope. But his attributes and his reign were so imperfectly understood that it became a subject of dispute whether he represented the bright orb of day or the gloomy monarch of the subterraneous regions. The Egyptians, who were obstinately devoted to the religion of their fathers, refused to admit this foreign deity within the walls of their cities. But the obsequious priests, who were seduced by the liberality of the Ptolemies, submitted without resistance to the power of the god of Pontus. An honorable and domestic genealogy was provided, and this fortunate usurper was introduced into the throne and bed of Osiris, the husband of Isis, and the celestial monarch of Egypt. Alexandria, which claimed his peculiar protection, gloried in the name of the city of Serapis. His temple, which rivaled the pride and magnificence of the capital, was erected on the spacious summit of an artificial mount, raised 100 steps above the level of the adjacent parts of the city, and the interior cavity was strongly supported by arches, and distributed into vaults and subterraneous apartments. The consecrated buildings were surrounded by a quadrangular portico, The stately halls and exquisite statues display the triumph of the arts, and the treasures of ancient learning were preserved in the famous Alexandrian Library, which had arisen with new splendor from its ashes. After the edicts of Theodosius had severely prohibited the sacrifices of the pagans, they were still tolerated in the city and temple of Serapis, and this singular indulgence was imprudently ascribed to the superstitious terrors of the Christians themselves, as if they had feared to abolish those ancient rites which could alone secure the inundations of the Nile, the harvests of Egypt, and the subsistence of Constantinople. At that time, the archiepiscopal throne of Alexandria was filled by Theophilus, the perpetual enemy of peace and virtue, a bold, bad man whose hands were alternately polluted with gold and with blood. His pious indignation was excited by the honors of Serapis, and the insults which he offered to an ancient temple of Bacchus convinced the pagans that he meditated a more important and dangerous enterprise. In the tumultuous capital of Egypt, the slightest provocation was sufficient to inflame a civil war. The votaries of Serapis, whose strength and numbers were much inferior to those of their antagonists, rose in arms at the instigation of the philosopher Olympius, who exhorted them to die in the defense of the altars of the gods. These pagan fanatics fortified themselves in the temple, or rather fortresses, of Serapis, repelled the besiegers by daring sallies and a resolute defense, and by the inhuman cruelties which they exercised on their Christian prisoners, obtained the last consolation of despair. The efforts of the prudent magistrate were usefully exerted for the establishment of a truce, till the answer of Theodosius should determine the fate of Serapis. The two parties assembled, without arms, in the principal square, and the imperial rescript was publicly read. But when a sentence of destruction against the idols of Alexandria was pronounced, the Christians set up a shout of joy and exultation, whilst the unfortunate pagans, whose fury had given way to consternation, retired with hasty and silent steps, and eluded by their flight or obscurity the resentment of their enemies. Theophilus proceeded to demolish the temple of Serapis without any other difficulties than those which he found in the weight and solidity of the materials. But these obstacles proved so insuperable that he was obliged to leave the foundations, and to content himself with reducing the edifice itself to a heap of rubbish, a part of which was soon afterwards cleared away to make room for a church erected in honor of the Christian martyrs. The valuable library of Alexandria was pillaged or destroyed, and near 20 years afterwards the appearance of the empty shelves excited the regret and indignation of every spectator whose mind was not totally darkened by religious prejudice. The compositions of ancient genius, so many of which have irretrievably perished, might surely have been accepted from the wreck of idolatry for the amusement and instruction of succeeding ages, and either the zeal or the avarice of the archbishop might have been satiated with the rich spoils which were the reward of his victory. While the images and vases of gold and silver were carefully melted, and those of a less valuable metal were contemptuously broken and cast into the streets, Theophilus labored to expose the frauds and vices of the ministers of the idols, their dexterity in the management of the lodestone, their secret methods of introducing a human actor into a hollow statue, and their scandalous abuse of the confidence of devout husbands and unsuspecting females. Charges like these may seem to deserve some degree of credit, as they are not repugnant to the crafty and interested spirit of superstition. But the same spirit is equally prone to the base practice of insulting and calumniating a fallen enemy, and our belief is naturally checked by the reflection that it is much less difficult to invent a fictitious story than to support a practical fraud. The colossal statue of Serapis was involved in the ruin of his temple and religion, a great number of plates of different metals artificially joined together composed the majestic figure of the deity who touched on either side the walls of the sanctuary. The aspect of Serapis, his sitting posture, and the scepter which he bore in his left hand were extremely similar to the extraordinary representations of Jupiter. He was distinguished from Jupiter by the basket or bushel which was placed on his head, and by the emblematic monster which he held in his right hand, the head and body of a serpent branching into three tails, which were again terminated by the triple heads of a dog, a lion, and a wolf. It was confidently affirmed that if any impious hand should dare to violate the majesty of the god, the heavens and the earth would instantly return to their original chaos. An intrepid soldier, animated by zeal and armed with a weighty battle-axe, ascended the ladder, and even the Christian multitude expected with some anxiety the event of the combat. He aimed a vigorous stroke against the cheek of Serapis. The cheek fell to the ground. The thunder was still silent, and both the heavens and the earth continued to preserve their accustomed order and tranquility. The victorious soldier repeated his blows. The huge idol was overthrown and broken in pieces, and the limbs of Serapis were ignominiously dragged through the streets of Alexandria. His mangled carcass was burnt in the amphitheatre amidst the shouts of the populace, and many persons attributed their conversion to this discovery of the impotence of their tutelar deity. The popular modes of religion that propose any visible and material objects of worship have the advantage of adapting and familiarizing themselves to the senses of mankind. But this advantage is counterbalanced by the various and inevitable accidents to which the faith of the idolater is exposed. It is scarcely possible that in every disposition of mind he should preserve his implicit reverence for the idols or the relics which the naked eye and the profane hand are unable to distinguish from the most common productions of art or nature. And if, in the hour of danger, their secret and miraculous virtue does not operate for their own preservation, he scorns the vain apologies of his priests, and justly derides the object and the folly of his superstitious attachment. After the fall of Serapis, some hopes were still entertained by the pagans that the Nile would refuse his annual supply to the impious masters of Egypt, and the extraordinary delay of the inundation seemed to announce the displeasure of the river god. But this delay was soon compensated by the rapid swell of the waters. They suddenly rose to such an unusual height as to comfort the discontented party with the pleasing expectation of a deluge, till the peaceful river again subsided to the well-known and fertilizing level of 16 cubits, or about 30 English feet. The temples of the Roman Empire were deserted or destroyed, but the ingenious superstition of the pagans still attempted to elude the laws of Theodosius, by which all sacrifices had been severely prohibited. The inhabitants of the country, whose conduct was less opposed to the eye of malicious curiosity, disguised their religious under the appearance of convivial meetings. On the days of solemn festivals, they assembled in great numbers under the spreading shade of some consecrated trees. Sheep and oxen were slaughtered and roasted, and this rural entertainment was sanctified by the use of incense and by the hymns which were sung in honor of the gods. But it was alleged that as no part of the animal was made a burnt offering, as no altar was provided to receive the blood, and as the previous oblation of salt cakes and the concluding ceremony of libations were carefully omitted, these festal meetings did not involve the guests in the guilt or penalty of an illegal sacrifice. Whatever might be the truth of the facts or the merit of the distinction, these vain pretenses were swept away by the last edict of Theodosius, which inflicted a deadly wound on the superstition of the pagans. This prohibitory law is expressed in the most absolute and comprehensive terms. "It is our will and pleasure," says the emperor, that none of our subjects, whether magistrates or private citizens, however exalted or however humble may be their rank and condition, shall presume in any city or in any place to worship an inanimate idol by the sacrifice of a guiltless victim. The act of sacrificing and the practice of divination by the entrails of the victim are declared, without any regard to the object of the inquiry, a crime of high treason against the state which can be expiated only by the death of the guilty. The rites of pagan superstition, which might seem less bloody and atrocious, are abolished as highly injurious to the truth and honor of religion. Luminaries, garlands, frankincense, and libations of wine are specially enumerated and condemned, and the harmless claims of the domestic genius of the household gods are included in this rigorous prescription. The use of any of these profane and illegal ceremonies subjects the offender to the forfeiture of the house or estate where they have been performed, and if he has artfully chosen the property of another for the scene of his impiety, he is compelled to discharge, without delay, a heavy fine of 25 pounds of gold, or more than 1,000 pounds sterling. A fine, not less considerable, is imposed on the connivance of the secret enemies of religion who shall neglect the duty of their respective stations either to reveal or to punish the guilt of idolatry. Such was the persecuting spirit of the laws of Theodosius, which were repeatedly enforced by his sons and grandsons with the loud and unanimous applause of the Christian world. Part 3. In the cruel reigns of Decius and Diocletian, Christianity had been proscribed as a revolt from the ancient and hereditary religion of the empire, and the unjust suspicions which were entertained of a dark and dangerous faction were in some measure countenanced by the inseparable union and rapid conquests of the Catholic Church. But the same excuses of fear and ignorance cannot be applied to the Christian emperors, who violated the precepts of humanity and of the gospel. The experience of ages had betrayed the weakness as well as folly of paganism. The light of reason and of faith had already exposed to the greatest part of mankind the vanity of idols, and the declining sect, which still adhered to their worship, might have been permitted to enjoy, in peace and obscurity, the religious costumes of their ancestors. Had the pagans been animated by the undaunted zeal which possessed the minds of the primitive believers, the triumph of the Church must have been stained with blood, and the martyrs of Jupiter and Apollo might have embraced the glorious opportunity of devoting their lives and fortunes at the foot of their altars. But such obstinate zeal was not congenial to the loose and careless temper of polytheism. The violent and repeated strokes of the orthodox princes were broken by the soft and yielding substance against which they were directed, and the ready obedience of the pagans protected them from the pains and penalties of the Theodosian code. Instead of asserting that the authority of the gods was superior to that of the emperor, they desisted, with a plaintive murmur, from the use of those sacred rites which their sovereign had condemned. If they were sometimes tempted by a sally of passion, or by the hopes of concealment to indulge their favorite superstition, their humble repentance disarmed the severity of the Christian magistrate, and they seldom refused to atone for their rashness by submitting with some secret reluctance to the yoke of the gospel. The churches were filled with the increasing multitude of these unworthy proselytes, who had conformed from temporal motives to the reigning religion. And whilst they devoutly imitated the postures and recited the prayers of the faithful, they satisfied their conscience by the silent and sincere invocation of the gods of antiquity. If the pagans lacked patience to suffer, they lacked spirit to resist. And the scattered myriads who deplored the ruin of the temples yielded, without a contest, to the fortunes of their adversaries. the disorderly opposition of the peasants of Syria and the populace of Alexandria to the rage of private fanaticism was silenced by the name and authority of the emperor. The pagans of the West, without contributing to the elevation of Eugenius, disgraced by their partial attachment the cause and character of the usurper. The clergy vehemently exclaimed that he aggravated the crime of rebellion by the guilt of apostasy, that by his permission the altar of victory was again restored, and that the idolatrous symbols of Jupiter and Hercules were displayed in the field against the invincible standard of the cross. But the vain hopes of the pagans were soon annihilated by the defeat of Eugenius, and they were left exposed to the resentment of the conqueror, who labored to deserve the favor of heaven by the extirpation of idolatry. A nation of slaves is always prepared to applaud the clemency of their master, who in the abuse of absolute power does not proceed to the last extremes of injustice and oppression. Theodosius might undoubtedly have proposed to his pagan subjects the alternative of baptism or of death, and the eloquent Libanius has praised the moderation of a prince who never enacted by any positive law that all his subjects should immediately embrace and practice the religion of their sovereign. The profession of Christianity was not made an essential qualification for the enjoyment of the civil rights of society, nor were any peculiar hardships imposed on the sectaries who credulously received the fables of Ovid and obstinately rejected the miracles of the gospel. The palace, the schools, the army, and the senate were filled with declared and devout pagans. They obtained, without distinction, the civil and military honors of the empire. Theodosius distinguished his liberal regard for virtue and genius by the consular dignity which he bestowed on Symmachus, and by the personal friendship which he expressed to Libanius. And the two eloquent apologists of paganism were never required either to change or to dissemble their religious opinions. The pagans were indulged in the most licentious freedom of speech and writing. The historical and philosophic remains of Eunapius, Zosimus, and the fanatic teachers of the school of Plato betray the most furious animosity and contain the sharpest invectives against the sentiments and conduct of their victorious adversaries. If these audacious libels were publicly known, we must applaud the good sense of the Christian princes, who viewed with a smile of contempt the last struggles of superstition and despair. But the imperial laws, which prohibited the sacrifices and ceremonies of paganism, were rigidly executed, and every hour contributed to destroy the influence of a religion which was supported by custom rather than by argument. The devotion of the poet or the philosopher may be secretly nourished by prayer, meditation, and study, but the exercise of public worship appears to be the only solid foundation of the religious sentiments of the people, which derive their force from imitation and habit. The interruption of that public exercise may consummate, in the period of a few years, the important work of a national revolution. The memory of theological opinions cannot long be preserved without the artificial help of priests, of temples, and of books. The ignorant vulgar, whose minds are still agitated by the blind hopes and terrors of superstition, will be soon persuaded by their superiors to direct their vows to the reigning deities of the age, and will insensibly imbibe an ardent zeal for the support and propagation of the new doctrine, which spiritual hunger at first compelled them to accept. The generation that arose in the world after the promulgation of the imperial laws was attracted within the pale of the Catholic Church. And so rapid, yet so gentle, was the fall of paganism that only 28 years after the death of Theodosius, the faint and minute vestiges were no longer visible to the eye of the legislator. The ruin of the pagan religion is described by the sophists as a dreadful and amazing prodigy which covered the earth with darkness and restored the ancient dominion of chaos and of night. They relate in solemn and pathetic strains that the temples were converted into sepulchres, and that the holy places which had been adorned by the statues of the gods were basely polluted by the relics of Christian martyrs. The monks, a race of filthy animals to whom Eunapius is tempted to refuse the name of men, are the authors of the new worship, which in the place of those deities who are conceived by the understanding has substituted the meanest and most contemptible slaves, the heads salted and pickled of those infamous malefactors who for the multitude of their crimes have suffered a just and ignominious death, their bodies still marked by the impression of the lash and the scars of those tortures which were inflicted by the sentence of the magistrate. Such, continues Eunapius, are the gods which the earth produces in our days. Such are the martyrs, the supreme arbitrators of our prayers and petitions to the deity, whose tombs are now consecrated as the objects of the veneration of the people. Without approving the malice, it is natural enough to share the surprise of the sophist, the spectator of a revolution which raised those obscure victims of the laws of Rome to the rank of celestial and invisible protectors of the Roman Empire. The grateful respect of the Christians for the martyrs of the faith was exalted by time and victory into religious adoration, and the most illustrious of the saints and prophets were deservedly associated to the honors of the martyrs. 150 years after the glorious deaths of St. Peter and St. Paul, the Vatican and the Ostian Road were distinguished by the tombs, or rather by the trophies, of those spiritual heroes. In the age which followed the conversion of Constantine, the emperors, the consuls, and the generals of armies devoutedly visited the sepulchres of a tent-maker and a fisherman, and their venerable bones were deposited under the altars of Christ, on which the bishops of the royal city continually offered the unbloody sacrifice. The new capital of the Eastern world, unable to produce any ancient and domestic trophies, was enriched by the spoils of dependent provinces. The bodies of St. Andrew, St. Luke, and St. Timothy had reposed near 300 years in the obscure graves from whence they were transported in solemn pomp to the Church of the Apostles, which the magnificence of Constantine had founded on the banks of the Thracian Bosphorus. About 50 years afterwards, the same banks were honored by the presence of Samuel, the judge and prophet of the people of Israel. His ashes, deposited in a golden vase and covered with a silken veil, were delivered by the bishops into each other's hands. The relics of Samuel were received by the people with the same joy and reverence which they would have shown to the living prophet. The highways from Palestine to the gates of Constantinople were filled with an uninterrupted procession, and the Emperor Arcadius himself, at the head of the most illustrious members of the clergy and senate, advanced to meet his extraordinary guest, who had always deserved and claimed the homage of kings. The example of Rome and Constantinople confirmed the faith and discipline of the Catholic world. The honors of the saints and martyrs, after a feeble and ineffectual murmur of profane reason, were universally established, and in the age of Ambrose and Jerome, something was still deemed wanting to the sanctity of a Christian church till it had been consecrated by some portion of holy relics, which fixed and inflamed the devotion of the faithful. In the long period of 1,200 years which elapsed between the reign of Constantine and the Reformation of Luther, the worship of saints and relics corrupted the pure and perfect simplicity of the Christian model, and some symptoms of degeneracy may be observed even in the first generations which adopted and cherished this pernicious innovation. 1. The satisfactory experience that the relics of saints were more valuable than gold or precious stones stimulated the clergy to multiply the treasures of the church. Without much regard for truth or probability, they invented names for skeletons and actions for names. The fame of the apostles and of the holy men who had imitated their virtues was darkened by religious fiction. To the invincible band of genuine and primitive martyrs they added myriads of imaginary heroes who had never existed, except in the fancy of crafty or credulous legendaries. And there is reason to suspect that Tours might not be the only diocese in which the bones of a malefactor were adored instead of those of a saint. A superstitious practice, which tended to increase the temptations of fraud and credulity, insensibly extinguished the light of history and of reason in the Christian world. 2. But the progress of superstition would have been much less rapid and victorious if the faith of the people had not been assisted by the seasonable aid of visions and miracles to ascertain the authenticity and virtue of the most suspicious relics. In the reign of the younger Theodosius, Lucian, a proester of Jerusalem, and the ecclesiastical minister of the village of Carpagamala, about 20 miles from the city, related a very singular dream, which, to remove his doubts, had been repeated on 3 successive Saturdays. A venerable figure stood before him in the silence of the night, with a long beard, a white robe, and a gold rod. Announced himself by the name of Gamaliel, and revealed to the astonished presbyter that his own corpse, with the bodies of his son Abibus, his friend Nicodemus, and the illustrious Stephen, the first martyr of the Christian faith, were secretly buried in the adjacent field. He added with some impatience that it was time to release himself and his companions from their obscure prison, that their appearance would be salutary to a distressed world, and that they had made choice of Lucian to inform the Bishop of Jerusalem of their situation and their wishes. The doubts and difficulties which still retarded this important discovery were successively removed by new visions, and the ground was opened by the bishop in the presence of an innumerable multitude. The coffins of Gamaliel, of his son, and of his friend were found in regular order. But when the 4th coffin, which contained the remains of Stephen, was shown to the light, the earth trembled, and an odour such as that of paradise was smelt, which instantly cured the various diseases of 73 of the assistants. The companions of Stephen were left in their peaceful residence of Carpagamala, but the relics of the first martyr were transported in solemn procession to a church constructed in their honour on Mount Sion, and the minute particles of those relics, a drop of blood or the scrapings of a bone, were acknowledged in almost every province of the Roman world to possess a divine and miraculous virtue. The grave and learned Augustine, whose understanding scarcely admits the excuse of credulity, has attested the innumerable prodigies which were performed in Africa by the relics of St. Stephen. And this marvellous narrative is inserted in the elaborate work of The City of God, which the Bishop of Hippo designed as a solid and immortal proof of the truth of Christianity. Augustine solemnly declares that he has selected those miracles only which were publicly certified by the persons who were either the objects or the spectators of the power of the martyr. Many prodigies were omitted or forgotten, and Hippo had been less favorably treated than the other cities of the province. And yet the bishop enumerates above 70 miracles, of which 3 were resurrections from the dead, in the space of 2 years, and within the limits of his own diocese. If we enlarge our view to all the dioceses and all the saints of the Christian world, it will not be easy to calculate the fables and the errors which issued from this inexhaustible source. But we may surely be allowed to observe that a miracle in that age of superstition and credulity lost its name and its merit, since it could scarcely be considered as a deviation from the ordinary and established laws of nature. 3. The innumerable miracles of which the tombs of the martyrs were the perpetual theatre revealed to the pious believer the actual state and constitution of the invisible world, and his religious speculations appeared to be founded on the firm basis of fact and experience. Whatever might be the condition of vulgar souls in the long interval between the dissolution and the resurrection of their bodies, it was evident that the superior spirits of the saints and martyrs did not consume that portion of their existence in silent and inglorious sleep. It was evident, without presuming to determine the place of their habitation or the nature of their felicity, that they enjoyed the lively and active consciousness of their happiness, their virtue, and their powers, and that they had already secured the possession of their eternal reward. The enlargement of their intellectual faculties surpassed the measure of the human imagination, since it was proved by experience that they were capable of hearing and understanding the various petitions of their numerous votaries, who in the same moment of time, but in the most distant parts of the world, invoked the name and assistance of Stephen or of Martin. The confidence of their petitioners was founded on the persuasion that the saints, who reigned with Christ, cast an eye of pity upon earth, that they were warmly interested in the prosperity of the Catholic Church, and that the individuals who imitated the example of their faith and piety were the peculiar and favorite objects of their most tender regard. Sometimes, indeed, their friendship might be influenced by considerations of a less exalted kind. They viewed with partial affection the places which had been consecrated by their birth, their residence, their death, their burial, or the possession of their relics. The meaner passions of pride, avarice, and revenge may be deemed unworthy of a celestial breast. Yet the saints themselves condescended to testify their grateful approbation of the liberality of their votaries, and the sharpest bolts of punishment were hurled against those impious wretches who violated their magnificent shrines or disbelieved their supernatural power. Atrocious indeed must have been the guilt, and strange would have been the skepticism of those men if they had obstinately resisted the proofs of a divine agency which the elements, the whole range of the animal creation, and even the subtle and invisible operations of the human mind were compelled to obey. The immediate and almost instantaneous effects that were supposed to follow the prayer or the offense satisfied the Christians of the ample measure of favor and authority which the saints enjoyed in the presence of the supreme God. And it seemed almost superfluous to inquire whether they were continually obliged to intercede before the throne of grace, or whether they might not be permitted to exercise, according to the dictates of their benevolence and justice, the delegated powers of their subordinate ministry. The imagination which had been raised by painful effort to the contemplation and worship of the universal cause eagerly embraced such inferior objects of adoration as were more proportioned to its gross conceptions and imperfect faculties. The sublime and simple theology of the primitive Christians was gradually corrupted, and the monarchy of heaven, already clouded by metaphysical subtleties, was degraded by the introduction of a popular mythology which tended to restore the reign of polytheism. 4. As the objects of religion were gradually reduced to the standard of the imagination, the rites and ceremonies were introduced that seemed most powerfully to affect the senses of the vulgar. If, in the beginning of the 5th century, Tertullian or Lactantius had been suddenly raised from the dead to assist at the festival of some popular saint or martyr, they would have gazed with astonishment and indignation on the profane spectacle which had succeeded to the pure and spiritual worship of a Christian.